Hello, I'm Will Shires, and this is Talking Trucks. In this episode, I'll be chatting with Chris Welch, the director at Welch's Transport. This family-run firm has just put an electric Renault Trucks 19-tonner on the road, and Chris gives us a fascinating insight into the pros and cons of running a zero tailpipe emission truck. If you're enjoying the podcast and want to stay abreast of everything that's happening in this industry, then why not subscribe to Commercial Motor Magazine? For great deals, head over to www.com-mot.com. That's www.com-mot.com. Chris, thank you for joining me. First of all, let's have a bit of history of Welch's Transport. How did it all start?
Welch's Transport. So it started in the Cambridgeshire Fields in 1934 with my great-granddad. So obviously I'm fourth generation now. And he started with one Morris petrol truck.
Okay.
We've got a little book on the story of our first 60 years, but if you read it from what I've been told around the dining table and at Christmas, it was literally an ad in the paper from a farmer saying, I need help transporting, clearing the fields and also transporting goods down to Covent Garden, as they did in those days.
Yeah.
So that's how it started in a little village about 10 miles from where we are now in Foxton, just over there in Cambridgeshire. So we started in the fields. War happened, so we had the old nationalisation, denationalisation.
Yes.
We go back and forth through that, so we had that since. And then obviously when it denationalised, we, in effect, he took back Cambridgeshire, Hertfordshire, a bit of Essex, local area, and we serviced it from there. Luckily around here, then we went into quarrying. There used to be a lot of lime quarries around here, okay. A lot of sand. So that's how we built up back in that period. And my granddad started, my uncle started, my dad started, and then it's my turn, I suppose. Through that period, it's been interesting. We haven't obviously now consolidated back into Cambridgeshire and Bedfordshire. We've got four depots here. St Ives, just north of Cambridge, not down in Cornwall.
Yep.
Bedford, Duxford, and we've got another depot in Essex and Witham that is still partly used as just house vehicles that we tramp with. Back in my granddad's day, we had contracts like all of BHS. We did all the warehousing distribution. We had hundreds of lorries on that. We had depots up in Scotland. It gave my granddad multiple heart attacks because back in those days, when you get a phone call at 2 a.m, you've got to drive up there, haven't you, unfortunately?
Right.
As opposed to getting on your emails or FaceTiming as we do now. Then Pallet Networks came along. In the 90s, didn't they? We were a founding member of Pallet Ways. We moved to Pallet Line 10 years later. So I've been in Pallet Line now for 12 years. RMD, my old man, Jim Welch, has just stepped down from being chairman of Pallet Line. So he did 10 years on the board. So we tried to stay integral to the industry from an SME point of view. Obviously, we go back multiple generations with the likes of Knowles's and Turner's and
yeah.
All the ones around here, Ellis's. And actually, I suppose, yeah, so we're obviously within the Transport Association still. We are now, so we were the first haulier to get invited from the founding six hauliers that founded it. We were the first haulier to get invited into the TA. And we are now the longest serving from 1955 because all the founding
wow.
members have in effect left or sold or folded or whatever's happened to them. So we've been in the TA since the Transport Association from 1955, and we're now it's longest service member. And it's
yeah.
not until you get in. I've now been in the business for about 8, 9 years. You have to go out and make all your mistakes somewhere else before you get into it.
Why did you make your mistakes?
A couple of local businesses. I did the whole university thing. Went down a management science pathway, covered a load of businesses. I used to work for a kind of Bright House-esque operation that did lots of rentals, so I worked their way through their graduate program and ended up being the general manager for the UK. Obviously that's warehousing, workshops, driver engineers, delivery drivers. So that kind of, that cemented my love of haulage, shall we say, and logistics and how it all comes together. And then I did 4 or 5 years at DHL. I used to run the local Cambridge DHL depot. So I love parcels, I love conveyor belts. And again, I worked for one of the biggest, in effect, they are the biggest global, the most global business out there, because they're in more countries than Coca-Cola, they'll tell you, because there's a couple of countries that don't have Coca-Cola because of
the American people, I guess.
So DHL are the most global company around the world, and at the end of the day, it's air freight, it's very time critical. Like, we would sort 5,000 parcels in an hour and have to get it to EMA in an hour and a half, kind of thing. Like, those kind of deadlines, what we do on time and full in this part of the industry gets obliterated by air freight. But it was really good to learn their ways of working, their culture, their KPIs, the way you run that kind of operation.
Yeah.
Then I came in, got invited in, the old man finally offered me a job, decided that I'd done enough. It was quite nice. I went back to the floor for 2 years. So I did my HGV back then, when it was class 2 and a class 1, as opposed to everything nowadays. I did that whilst I was at uni, so when I left uni I was an agency driver whilst I found myself a job, so I've had my licence.
Oh, so you've actually done some driving?
20 years. Whoa! 20 years, because it was back 18 back then, wasn't it? So it was 21, sorry. I'm getting old. So I came into the business, did 2 years back to the floor, drove all the routes, worked on the different contracts. Back then, we used to run all the paper chases, distribution for the UK. We worked with CPI, we had dry powder tankers. I've done all the hubs, we're in Hascam as well, so I've done all the different night freights. And it's quite nice going from DHL, we have back then a BlackBerry, because we used to have BlackBerries, and from having a BlackBerry tied to your hand, to actually being a driver for a couple of years and tramping and working your way for the business. So it's quite nice then being back out on the road and just listening to the radio while you trundle up and down the country, or just sit in traffic as we do nowadays. And then I worked my way through the business, sorted out different depots, and I became a commercial operations director about 5 years ago now, and since then I've been trying to shape transport. Obviously within our group we have, over those 90 years, those 9 decades, you diversify into a lot of things, don't you? Contracts come to an end and you might keep a bit, like, start to carry on it yourself.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, in the Welch Group, 70% of what we do is transport. Welch's transport is 70% of our group, and that does include warehousing, e-commerce, contract distribution. We've got about 100,000 square foot of warehousing. But sitting beside that, we've got our truck centre. So we've been an OEM service dealer and reseller for the past 30, 40 years. We've gone from ERF to MAN to DAF, and then we've been settled with Renault for the past 12 or so years, which has been a great experience.
Which explains why you're virtually 100% Renault.
Which explains why we're, nearly 100% Renault, apart from a couple of Mitsubishi Canters and a couple of DAF 44 tons, just so I can try and keep Renault a little bit honest.
Yeah.
Because now we're not a reseller, we're just a service agent. So I've got to keep the likes of Allports and people like that thinking a little bit.
Keep them on the toes.
Exactly. And then we have a specialist movement division. We've got crane hire. We've got low loaders. We've got all those bits and pieces that you facilitate for your customers over the years. We're now in the luxury of being able to move. We can move a parcel through our e-commerce division, or we can move a boat in a plane through our specialist movement division, and then everything in between. So in effect, we can pick up, uninstall, pick up, move, reinstall, put down, deliver, anything you like. I've moved Spitfires, I've moved silos, we've got Hazardous division, so yeah, we try and be a bit of a one-stop shop. It's 50% of our stuff, 70% of stuff in the middle just being palletized nowadays. Everything's palletized in the middle there.
Yeah. Okay, now we came to see you back in the summer when you had your Roadnet Zero Festival.
Yep.
Tell us about that. I mean, there's going to be a story in Commercial Motor Magazine around about the time this podcast comes out. But talk us through it. What was the point of it?
What was the point of it? It started out as, obviously we decided very early on that we were going to be early adopters of EV. We can talk around different fuel types, but in my head, EV is end game. There's a place for hydrogen and other modes of fueling, shall we say, and obviously then we've got the whole dropping fuels, HVO, all the bits and pieces in the middle, compressed gas. But I think it's the long game's EV. So we being part of Renault, and Renault have a probably one of the leading OEM ranges for EV. We went to them and talked to them, demoed the 19-ton early last year, and decided that A, it was the right thing to do. B, due to our workshops and our Renault dealership, we wanted to be one of the first Renault dealers to actually be working on an active HGV. So okay, you offset the risk a little bit. And where we are in the country, we're in Cambridgeshire. Like, this is the Silicon Valley. Like, there's a lot of potential business here that we haven't never been able to tap into, because of the nature of what they do, and they are one of the four leaders in wanting to promote green anything, green logistics, green supply chain, green building, the whole lot. So we had a couple of extra cards that probably a lot of other people don't. And then it comes down to other little pieces like infrastructure. We've got a nice site here in Duxford. We built it. We've got our own substation. We own it. We can facilitate running an EV a lot easier than unfortunately a lot of haulers can. So we signed up to an the old man signed the order last Easter for the EV, and the Road to Net Zero Festival came about because we thought, well, we need to put it in front of the customers. It is still one of the first ones in the UK. So we need to put customers in front of it to see it. Because if you see it on the road, it looks like any other lorries, unless you're listening hard and you don't hear it.
And it's an E-Tech D, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. So the festival, well, back then it was just a show and tell day, shall we say. It was like, we need to get our customers, we need to invite them over to our place, get the lorry out and show it to them. But parallel to that, obviously, we have been doing a lot of work around infrastructure. We did a lot of work with the Energy Saving Trust last year, where they gave us a roadmap for our main depot here in Cambridge to go fully electric and what it would take, the different steps we would need. We've been working with infrastructure people like Zenobi about battery storage on site, PV, all those kind of things. So the journey that we've been on the last 12 months and the conversations that I've been having within the Transport Association and my peers and the local hauliers around here, actually we're doing all this work and you actually then look behind you and you realise everyone's watching you, completely oblivious to us, because we just thought it was what you should do and what we thought we needed to do to take the business forward.
Yeah.
And then you turn around and everyone's watching you, and you talk to Richard at the RHA and he's like, well, yeah, you're probably only one of half a dozen, Chris, or one of 10 or 12 now that actually are trying to tackle this and do something different. Talk about it in the TA, like I say, in the Transport Association. So I started to think, well, there's nothing selfish here at the end of the day. Why don't we make this Road to Net Zero Festival a festival and actually allow our peers and allow us to showcase what we've been up to and what we've learned. So obviously, at the end of the day, people have got to undertake this transition to alternative fuels because it's legislative now. The government have drawn a line in the sand. We have dates that we have to achieve. And whilst obviously at the decarbonised summit at the other end of last year, where we were there listening to what was going on and the attitude of everyone from SME right up to the big boys, I don't think it had really sunken in end of last year, and there's been a massive culture and attitude shift in what I've seen in the last 10 months, and I've had a lot of phone calls from members in Palletline and Hascem, the networks themselves, saying like, Chris, what you've been up to, why are you doing it, how is it going, because we've had it for 3 months now, and I thought, because of how we've operated for the past 90 years and how we do collaborate and how we still respect our local Haulier TA members' boundaries, and we still work collaborative, we still backload, allows us SMEs to have to compete with the big boys. That's actually what you don't see in the industry, is how much we work together. And at that point I was like, well, let's just open the door, let's actually make this all we can make it. So then I started talking to Renault, I started talking to Zenobi. Obviously we're doing a big piece in-house about my future dark traffic office, about AI optimization. So we actually turned it into a showcase, and I went to my partners and said, and our new partners, and said, would you like to make this something special? Would you like to actually make it a little bit of an expo, if we will, promote what you've got to sell, what you're doing on the road to net zero, and then how it obviously is being facilitated, or how it's impacting my standard, pretty standard SME operation, which is half our fleet's half of our 80 fleet is trampers, half of it's radial vehicles. We've got a pretty, in my eyes, we've got a pretty standard haulage operation here. We still do old school general haulage, and we're part of Pallet Network, so it encompasses everything that any hauler in the UK is probably doing right now, apart from a bit of multimodal and sticking on trains. It turned into a festival. It turned into having a bar and having multiple food vans and live music at the end of the day.
How many people did you get?
We probably had, over the course of the day, we probably saw about 300, which was good. I was hoping for more, but it was a bit like having gone to the CV show this year and ITT Hub this year. CV show had a lot of people having a look. The ITT Hub had a lot less people, but a lot more meaningful conversations from what I had. So again, it was new, it was different, and the people that turned up actually wanted to turn up and learn something. So the people that we had here weren't just skiving for the day from work, they actually wanted to come and learn about infrastructure or vehicles. And like I say, Renault were great. We had their new electric cargo bike's not coming out till next year, we're the only one in the country.
We had the road transport expo.
That was the first time it was allowed out, and literally I had it delivered here after the road expo. We had the Optimodal, which is cargo bike and van and drone all in one. Optimodal, because it's French. We do also think that these vehicles are very applicable to urban consolidation and last mile and last meter delivery, Renault are now terming it. That's part of this new opportunity within the market to do something different with these vehicles, because they're very expensive, they don't go very far. So you do have to explore other avenues for it.
Right, tell us exactly what the truck's, how's it settled into the fleet? What's it doing? What sort of range have you got, and where you're charging it? Let's hear some of that.
Oh, so I have a lovely Renault D19, which has obviously been reclassified to 9-ton, and there's obviously the conversation there about reclassifying to 20-ton, which is handy. So vital statistics. We've seen, having operated it 3 months, we are comfortable in putting it out on 140 mile round trip. So okay. That's the range. We know we're comfortable there. The driver's got over his range anxiety, like I do in my car. And that's the range that we're allowing it to go. We put a 26 ton body on it to utilise it as much as we could. Yep. And we put a nice big eco cab on it to make it as comfortable for the driver. So we did actually sacrifice a bit of weight. And it's got a big tail lift on the back, obviously, as well. So it comes at the factory of 9-ton, and ours actually will handle about 7.5, which is a lot less than other manufacturers. Well, not sorry, not less than other manufacturers, a lot less the spec.
And the diesel equivalent.
A lot less diesel equivalent, and everyone else that's been trialling and buying these vehicles have specced it with a day cab or a smaller box or a lighter tail lift to keep that payload up.
Yes.
Where at the end of the day, again, when we come to what we're using for, the backup for this is we use it on pallet networks, because it can get critical mass. It, obviously, radial vehicles, they don't go very far. So we've had our network to fall back on when it can't be utilised on EV, or customer EV work, shall we say. And at that point, you don't need 9, 9.5 ton like you'd get in an 18 ton, because it's network, so you're very, very unlucky if you get a full load of turf to go to someone's house, which is 12 ton because it's 12 pallet spaces. So again, because of the work that we were going to obviously it would have to rely on until we got business for it. 7.5 ton is actually okay. But we had spec to be a bigger body, so we can get 16 pallets on it. We can get 21 cages. We had it spec for cages, because again, we're looking at urban consolidation. So we had it, we had runners put in it, so we can put 21 cages on it. So it's quite a very versatile vehicle. Charging wise, we took the decision to put a supercharger in. So that went in January. So again, I like to talk about the fact that we were the first publicly accessible HGV charger in the UK, because you can come into my same as the Transport Association come in to fill up a diesel in my depot, you can come in and charge your lorry in my depot.
Really?
Yeah. We've got some nice big blue EHGV parking spaces next to the supercharger. So yeah, so as of January, we had anyone could come use our supercharger the same as we sell fuel.
So how long does that take to charge?
So our Renault, it's a 265 kilowatt battery, so it takes 150 kilowatt supercharger, so it takes about an hour and a half to get to about 80-90%.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Can I ask what a supercharger costs?
Supercharger sets you back probably about 50 grand, and then probably about another 5 grand to install it, because that's a very, very big, powerful cable that you've got to run from your junction box or wherever you run it from. So it is a big investment. But again, it's that foresight. I mean, the backup work, like I said, for this, or the day-to-day work now for this vehicle is pallet line, is network, and it's Hazchem as well. We run, it's ADR compliant, it's all spec'd up, and you are allowed to run ADR on battery electric. They haven't sorted out hydrogen yet, but battery electric EV, BEV, is fine to run ADR on. So it runs around our local area doing network for both networks, and because of that, it needs to multi-run. It needs to do two runs in a day. It needs to come back at lunchtime, top up, driver has his break, 45 minutes, stuck on the supercharger. Even if he's had a full 100-mile run in the morning, it'll still get back up to where it needs to be in 45 minutes, reloaded to go back out. And then the conversations we have at the moment with potential customers is night runs. So I need to triple shift this vehicle to make money.
Really, it's going to be triple shifted?
So if you double shift single shift that vehicle on network, you're going to lose money all day long, all week long, all year long. If you can double shift it on network, we've found, especially Hazchem, because of the premium you get paid for dangerous goods, it will break even, turn a tiny profit. Obviously, at that point, you're sacrificing the 100 odd pound that your diesel would have made, your ICE vehicle would have made, but it's the right thing to do. If we can triple shift it, do some night work with it, that's when you start making money out of these vehicles. And again, you're offsetting what you make on an ICE vehicle, but that's the idea. So the idea is it's triple shifted, and you have, at that point, you need to supercharge it twice in the day, or three times in the day in the whole cycle. So that's the reason we haven't just gone with a 22 kilowatt out of the three-phase juice booster, although we have that for backup, because you need a contingency. That's why we went 150 kilowatt. But again, there's the synergies in different parts of the group. Obviously, here is where we run the Renault dealership, and we're now a fully EV-compliant Renault dealer service centre, but one of the stipulations to be a service centre is that you need a supercharger, because as we transition to EV and people have their vehicle serviced or PDI'd or whatever's happening with them, they would like a charge at the end of that service to be able to leave with a full charge, not just given half a battery back.
Yeah.
So, it's offset within multiple parts of our bit within our group, so it's easier for us to swallow, shall we say. And there's then the commercial benefit potentially in the future of being able to resell electric, because the infrastructure is still not where it needs to be.
So how have you budget? Have you leased this?
No, bought it. We like paying cash for everything. Well, my old man does. But again, it's also, I think we're the only ones, be it stupid or however people say, we're the only one, talking to my peers, we're the only one that's actually gone out and paid cash for it.
Certainly the first I've heard of.
Yeah, everyone else has HP'd it or got a deal with the manufacturer or go back and they'd have to wait the residue. So in effect, at the end of the day, we're writing it off. We're writing it off. We've obviously extended our depreciation model on it. But again, you get into this, because of our understanding of the truck centre and the servicing of bits and pieces, you get into this idea that in my head, these vehicles will run a lot longer than your current diesels do. So normally people will run four, five, 6 years maybe, or if you were talking about 44 tonnes, you try and not run over a million kilometres. But I see these vehicles working a lot like the coaches do. So coaches go on forever, don't they, in some instances. And as long as that chassis can hold up, and a bit like what we do with trailers, we refurb them after 6 years and they get another 4 years life out of them. So that's kind of our thinking now going forward with these
BEVs. Yeah, so like new driver's seat, new curtains, yeah. That kind of thing. Just a new lease of life.
Yeah, new lease of life. And then you come on to the batteries. And again, we've already changed batteries in this vehicle and in other vehicles.
Why have you already changed the batteries?
So it's early adoption. No, so when we purchased it, it came. Renault had it straight out of the factory. Like they were like, yes, sold electric rigid. They actually give you a priority build slot. It goes straight in. It comes straight out.
Yeah.
So we had this BEV in the country before Christmas last year. But then you've got to put a box on it, haven't you?
Yeah.
And no one's put a box on these things, or not many people have put a box on these things before. So then you come into the early adoption learning phase of the journey. And when I got really annoyed that I saw more and more other BEVs come onto the road, and I was no longer the first, second or third person to get one, which was, I'm not bitter about at all. but no, it was no one's fault. It was the fact that the bodybuilder had never worked one before, and like a normal body, you can't just bang bolts.
Who is the bodybuilder?
I can't actually remember. It's through our Renault dealer, Allports. They wanted to use their bodybuilder to be able to keep close tabs on it. We always use Kurt Hobbs down here in this neck of the woods. But rightly so, Allports wanted to use theirs because then they could have better control of it. But it's that early adoption, it's that unknown, it's the fact that they couldn't just bang bolts to the floor into a massive battery block.
Yeah.
They had to figure out properly. Obviously, again, like I said, we had a higher spec box put on it. We wanted runners for cage security. It's obviously got all sorts of different livery on it. But it was the unknown, and they don't have the facility to... They had the facility to do a box. They didn't have the facility for an electric vehicle, so they didn't have a charger. So over that course of time, that battery slowly went flat, because it wasn't Renault don't give it like in any car Renault don't give it to you with a full battery, like before you arrive them about 10-20%, and then everyone, because it's new, everyone thought, oh, do we need to charge it at some point, is it going down? So over those course of the 3-4 months it took to do the body,
it just
went down, and I've got to send it to the local Renault dealer to get PDI'd and a few updates and bits and pieces, and between them again no one thought to charge it, so
yeah,
it in effect died. So when an EV dies, you're not allowed to let an EV completely die, because it dies. It's not like jump starting your battery in your car. It's like your laptop going down. It's like your laptop battery going down. It's pardon my French, buggered. So we had to then get an engineer out from Volvo, from Sweden or somewhere, to come out with a special tool, because again, there's not this tool in the UK to, in effect, we call it, we were just referring to it as a defibrillator. They've come to defib the rigid. That's, again, there's no tool in the UK. They had to schedule it in. It took 6 weeks for the engineer to come out, and then took him a week to then slowly go back to the battery. You've in effect got to like coax them back to life, shall we say. But you had to take the body back off it, because they'd done certain work, and it's not like changing a battery. It's not a certain way. They've got to get to all of it. So they've got to take the part of the body back off and part of the floor back out.
Oh, what a nightmare.
And that's not how you service them. Again, so we've already changed the battery. So it was a bit of a nightmare. And they managed to get it all back working, 100% charge. But one of the batteries, within that time, although they charged it at that point with that special tool, one of the batteries did fail. So one of the four battery cells failed. So they finished it all off, ready for delivery, and then came rang us up and said, it's only taking a 75% charge. And they were like, well, one of the batteries is broken then, isn't it? Because there's four batteries, 25% each, yeah. 75%. And we said, forget it, don't worry. We're now in a fully approved Renault dealership, EV dealer. Just get it to us. Better still, I'll send my specialist movements to come and collect it from you, because you're finished, you sign it off. I'll bring it here, and then I'll sort out with Renault changing the battery under warranty, because it's still under warranty. So we got it back, and within the first week, we had already changed the battery cell on it. But again, this piece about R&M and about the unknown and how servicing is going to work. Not being funny, I've had a rigid in our workshop for 2 weeks now, because an injector went and it made a massive mess of the engine block, and that's been in there for a week or so, because it's a long job. You've got to order the parts. There's a lot of mechanical bits to it because it's an engine. the battery went on this vehicle, it could still work, it still went out and did work until that day it was needed to replace the battery, so you could still run it at 75% because you just got a 90 mile range as opposed to 140 mile range. Went into the workshop, you get a special table from Renault, you discharge the vehicle so it doesn't kill anyone, you put the table underneath, you in effect unplug the battery like you would in most appliances, it popped it out, you put the new one back in, you plug it back in, you do a software update, and it's back in the road that day. So like the main thing that can go wrong with these vehicles obviously is the battery or a motor.
Yes.
And in my eyes, that's how simple it was to get this vehicle back on the road, and the fact that you could, and from a battery point of view, you could still use it. But then you come in, the interesting things is actually, especially from a service dealer point of view, is that that battery cost us about 35 grand. So you can see why the value of these
vehicles. Really?
So half to a third or to a half of these vehicles' value is the battery, the four battery cells. So it's under warranty, doesn't matter. But coming from a service dealer point of view, I had to buy a battery that then's a warranty job that then Transport pays for, and then I get the money back from Renault as a warranty job, and that's the chain of events.
Yeah.
As our workshop transitions to EV, and we work from anywhere between 8 and 12 vehicles at any one time in that, because we've got a multi-bay workshop. In 10 years, if I have even just 5 vehicles in there having a battery replacement, that means I've got to spend 5 times 35 grand on parts. So that's a lot more than paying 2 grand for part of an engine or a wheel or a tire or a prop shaft or whatever the other bits and pieces you might replace are. So there's a head scratching exercise here to be done within the OEMs and within the service dealerships, because that is a hell of a cash flow to have in your business to be able to replace batteries. And then you come into the interesting bits about, well, batteries can't just be stored, they can't just be put on a shelf, you need to store them in a battery array, so it drip charges them, it doesn't fully charge them, but it needs to keep that cycle going so we don't have the same scenario happen that we had in the first place. There's a lot of interesting things having to go on in the background here in the service industry to facilitate these vehicles as well, let alone the charging infrastructure. But again, there's lots of opportunities. Like we've been talking to people, we can put a battery array in that allows us to store these batteries. And not being funny, I'm going to connect it to the PV on my roof and have, in effect, free battery storage. That's one option that's been thrown around the table. So there's always a silver lining. There's always an opportunity to be had in any of these scenarios. Yeah. You just don't want to dwell on the money.
So has there been any other teething issues?
Yes, there's always teething issues. I mean, again, that you have that transition from the driver. So we picked 2 drivers to drive it, and we have an in-house driver trainer. So I have 3 drivers that are kind of signed off to drive it, because at the end of the day, anyone that's obviously trying to get an insurance premium for one of these things, they're driving around a house at the end of the day.
Of course.
Or in this day and age, at least a 2-bedroom house. So there's the driver training piece. Because initially everyone's like, oh, it's electric. Because again, not many people drive an electric car. Like I can count on one hand the amount of electric cars we've got carded in the car park outside for our staff. So there's the anxiety of getting in it. So that's I suppose a teething problem, because you've got to earmark, you've got to find those drivers that want to go in it and explore it and work with you to work on the future of the industry, shall we say.
Yeah.
That was good. Like I say, every haul of operation knows who their drivers are that would like to do that, and twice since then we've now got drivers lining up to want to be trained on the EV, which is great. It's a great thing to see, because they all talk and they all learn that actually it's got an amazing amount of torque, like you see in your cars, like it is a different thing to drive.
Yeah.
But it's also just as important to manage that driver performance, because again, we're moving from MPG to kilowatt miles per hour, or mile kilowatt, whichever way around it is. And again, you still have to manage that performance, because you accelerate too much, you brake too much, you don't use the regen that it obviously has within a battery, the curve system that like F1 cars have. There's a lot. There is the same. there's the same piece around driver performance and environmental driving and being aware of your surroundings as there is with MPG. And again, we all know what electricity prices are like at the moment. You have to manage that how much energy you have to put in that vehicle. So that was a journey, not necessarily a teething problem, but that was a journey and something that everyone needs to understand. The main one, I suppose, is the charging of the vehicle. So like I say, we have a supercharger. Again, it was the first one that our installation company had installed, that we got through with a Project EV. So that's the first one that our local dealer, it was the first supercharger that they had installed. They do loads of residential, they do loads of 22 kilowatt in car parks. First supercharger they had installed these guys. So there's the teething problems there, there's the setup. We want to be able to monitor it. Obviously, again, this activity, this move to electric, and just the industry as a whole is all data hungry now, isn't it? You need to know everything, especially when you go down this road. So I need to know who's charging it, when they're charging it, how much they're charging it, what the efficiency performance is. And twice the Renault Optifleet we're trialling at the same time as this, so I'm actually getting those reports from Renault Optifleet for performance, and I just check it against my supercharger report. So it's quite a nice way of doing it. But again, superchargers, as we found out, are hungry beasts. We've blown 200 amp fuses in our switchboards because of it has a bad day and it blows loads of fuses, and it's a learning thing. Yes. So one day it's not working and you're like, well, you're on the phone to the tech engineer and he has to come out, and you're going through these bits and pieces, and you don't actually think to go back to the main board and go, because everything else is working in your depot. So normally when a light goes out, you go and look at the fuse board. So there's those little pieces. I came in this morning and for some reason, it's all controlled through an app, and for some reason my iPhone and my app was working perfectly, but the driver's Android on his app wasn't working, and it was saying that the charger wasn't available. So there's all sorts of little things, and it's just understanding that roadmap and then what you need to do. We've had the guys at Project EV have been great, and we've had them in here a few times, and we're creating like work to schedules and quick fire guides and troubleshooting, and it helps again being very system based, because we've got the whole portal, we can go into the back of it, we can look at different things. I get alerts if it drops out from the internet, so obviously it connects in bits and pieces. So probably the charging is the biggest headache, shall we say. Especially, but then again, that's why we've obviously got a backup juice booster, which plugs into a normal three phase, and that puts out 22 kilowatts. So that, if it's not triple shifted, that will charge in 5-6 hours overnight. So again, that's a way that a lot of people are doing it. But again, our attitude towards this and our idea is it gets triple shifted to make money. They're probably the biggest ones.
So is these problems you mentioned there, are they a disadvantage or an advantage for being an early adopter? Because disadvantage, you've had all this hassle, but advantage, you won't in the future, whereas other people will.
No, exactly. And again, we come back to the sharing of knowledge at our Net Zero Festival. I mean, I'm a smiley guy, I'm a happy guy, I'm always a glass half full kind of guy. And it is all opportunity. So we've got, again, we said about it, we've got a supercharger, we've learned how the pitfalls of it, we had to get it installed, we know, like, you learn where you can get it. There's obviously a certain power degrade as it goes through a cable, even those cables are like the size of my leg. There's only certain places you can put it in within your operation. We learned that. But at the end of the day, we had one of the first superchargers that's public accessible in the UK. So now we are promoting that, and there's a commercial opportunity to be had, because you go and park in a service station and charge your car at 65p a kilowatt. We're buying it in at a peak, we're buying it at about 36, 38, and there's a halfway house to be had there. So not really funny, people could charge their truck for more in my depot than they could if the service centres get up. Sorry, service, roadside services pick it up as well. And I can imagine that they won't be charging 65 kilo peak a kilowatt for a HGV, they'll be putting a premium on that because it's a HGV as well. So again, it's looking at opportunity. The supercharger, again, it's the opportunity to triple shift it. It's the opportunity we had in our truck centre to become EV compliant and be an EV compliant service dealer for Renault. There's lots more ticks in the pro box than there was for the early adoption piece.
Yeah. Now, I see on your website you publish a monthly diesel surcharge rate, so you're really proactive on that.
Yeah.
Does the same happen with the electric truck?
No. And again, I don't think we could get away with... Well, sorry, there's a premium on electric. There's a premium on electric, obviously, and we can now work that out based upon the performance data of the vehicle, and we know we get X amount of miles per kilowatt. So we've come up with a new pence per mile calculation, so we can build it into our rate cards or into spot hire. I don't think we can get away with doing a fuel surcharge or mechanism, however you want to refer to it, because most people understand that your electric bill is fixed. So they, in theory, know that I have a fixed kilowatt per hour pence charge. I would love to build an escalator in, but it will just be the same. It will be the same exercise that we all do once a year or twice a year, however often we do rate reviews. And when our electric comes up for renewal, which is I think about 2 years from now, there will be a change in the rate card for electric, and we'll communicate that, saying, right, everyone knows that you have to rebase your electric. Hopefully in 2 years it's going to come back down or continue to come down. And I think that's the best way to go at it. You do need to keep it as a separate entity on your sheet, because it is a different ball game. And again, you do need to be covering your costs. We could try and do a job for a customer with the EV and then put a fuel surcharge on it, because it'll probably come out about right at the moment, but they might start scratching their head.
That's right.
Put your diesel in it.
So what do your customers think of it, and what do the public think of it?
We'll start with customers. Customers, they love the idea of it. They love to talk about it, but as we all know in the industry, they don't like putting their hand in their pocket. And to be honest, I was talking to Sam Fagan at Fagan & Wally earlier in the week, and he made an excellent analogy, and he said people don't have the right attitude towards like value of delivery. And I thought that really resonated with me. Like, people have the green agenda, or within their businesses want to make things greener, but they don't understand the value of the delivery. If we have a lot of us in the country now have electric lorries, and we can offer green supply chain solutions. And not, I was doing some rough calculations this morning. This vehicle on a normal day's just a normal charge run saves about 55 kilograms of CO2 over the course of a normal run. Okay. My maths might be wrong, but that's how I calculated it out. So there's some very quick savings to be had here with the green agenda for our customers. We're not charging the earth for it. I mean, as I say, we have our standard rates, and again, has an ADR freight is usually priced at about 30, 40, 50% more than standard non-ADR freight. I mean, we're only putting about another 25%, 30% on top of what ADR freight is to do EV. So it's not that, I'm not asking for hundreds of percent increase on my current rates. It's not actually a massive step, but people get hung up on, they don't like diving in too much. They get hung up on the range. Oh, we can't do this, this and this. But you can do this, this and this. So we've gone away with our key customers and gone, right, well, this is your delivery profile for the past year, past 6 months. These are all the customer delivery locations within a radius that a vehicle can achieve. They aren't just single pallets. They are reasonably meaty deliveries, like 4 or 5 ton. This is the price for what we could do from electric. And they go, great, amazing, thanks, Chris. And disappear. And it's like, anyway, like you give someone, you try and win a customer, you give them a rate card, and they say, excellent, great, yeah, you've done me a good deal. Let me go away and think about it. And then obviously, again, it's the time of year. It's August, it's July. He's gone away on holiday for 2 weeks. So it just gets stagnant and stalls at this time of year, doesn't it? It's been amazingly received. And again, we come across to this urban consolidation piece that we're trying to land with a lot of the science parks and research parks around Cambridge, which again was another reason we took this step. They've been great. We've had open days, we've done launch parties, but then you get into the bureaucracy. Like, the tenants love the idea of having all their stuff, all their ambulances and all the other stuff delivered on an electric vehicle. No more vehicles around the park, maybe put a cargo bike or a van in there as well, all electric, all quiet. But then you get into the bureaucracy of having to deal with these kind of businesses, and it goes up the chain, and it just gets slower and slower the further it goes up the chain.
Yeah.
The more and more meetings you have. But I've got no shadow of doubt from a UCC point of view what we're trying to do with these businesses and organisations. Cambridge, once you land one, it will turn heads, the case study will be there, and it will snowball, in my humble opinion, and I'm hoping it will, because we've betted quite a lot on it. And it's the same with the industry. As soon as people start seeing the application for these vehicles, and Wincanton and Manchester, well, like I say, Carlsberg have got one, Warburton's Bread have got one, and they're running routes every day in London non-stop, because the freight and the routes match it, and again, it's in those instances it's backed by their brand, isn't it? They're just facilitating it. They don't have a separate partner for haulage, it's them.
Yeah.
So it's a bit easier. But no, there's more and more of these coming into the arena. Again, from a network point of view, I'm obviously already talking to Paletline and Haskim about utilising these vehicles. We're talking about 40-tonne night runs when we start trialling them at the end of the year. And it'll be a bit like Fours. At some point, enough members within your network will have an electric vehicle, and at that point, it can become a service offering within the network. Mm. There's no point Paletline promoting the fact that they've got two EVs with us and Masters and Knowles's in Cambridgeshire, and sorry, Mitcham's in Paletline. So they've actually got three EVs in the country that could do EV deliveries. But twice, you need to get 12, you need to get to 15. You need to be able to hit most major cities for it then to be commercially viable for Paletline to promote it.
Yeah.
And it's just those steps, those baby steps.
And are the drivers getting feedback from the public?
Public. Joe Public. Love him. Yeah, the drivers are getting really good feedback from the delivery points. Obviously a lot of it is amazement. They're like, "Oh, we didn't realise these things are on the road yet. Oh, is that electric? I didn't hear you come in," kind of thing. And then the driver spends 5-10 minutes when he should be doing work showing everyone the vehicle. So it's like it is a road show every day. So it gets very well received, and obviously we've got special livery on it, promoting the fact that it's 100% electric, net zero, all these bits and pieces. And it was quite interesting when we did like a little photo day when we first got it. We obviously got the photographer out and got lots of candid photos here, there and everywhere. And you're driving around the middle of Cambridge, in the Market Square area, whilst you can still get in there before 10 o'clock in the morning. And there's a lot of tourists in Cambridge and a lot of bicycles in Cambridge, and they're kind of oblivious to it because everyone's used to hearing lorries. Yeah. Like, if you know a lorry's coming because you can hear it, or a van. And we're there with the photographer, and my driver trainer was in there taking it around for the day. And you've had these people taking photos of King's College on the backs of Cambridge, and they were taking photos, they put their camera down, they turn around and they jump out of their skin because there's a massive 19-tonne lorry standing behind them, and they have no idea where it is. And again, when you're crawling and manoeuvring in those kind of urban areas, people are oblivious to the fact that you are actually moving. It's the sound aspect. It's what everyone's been saying, obviously, for the last few years with cars and going EV and how it's going to be a lot more unsafe. I don't think that's the case. Obviously, we haven't seen any more road deaths, I don't think, or pedestrian deaths with EVs, because you can still hear them. You listen for a different noise.
Sure.
And it's the same with the lorry. At the end of the day, we have evolved from cavemen, and we're used to just spending our days looking around to make sure we're not going to get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. Like, there's something in us that makes us look in our peripheries. Like, we should just go back to not looking at our smartphones and looking at our surroundings, and it's just going to be a change of culture. But then they stand there amazed because they've seen their first electric lorry, and that's the best bit. Like, people actually being amazed that these things are out and about and being used, and are being used properly and not just parked up most of the time and used once or twice for PR opportunities. So it's been really, really well received. We just need more business out of it.
So what's next then? I mean, I know Renault are launching their electric tractor units next year. Are you thinking you're going to go down that route?
Yep, so I've obviously been harassing Carlo and Andy and Jake, Jack, sorry. Yeah, we're definitely going to be trialling one as soon as they can give us one. I hope that's by Q4, maybe beginning of Q1. And again, it's horses for courses, isn't it? It's looking at your operation and going, right, actually, with this limited mileage, and again, the supercharger has come into play massively when we start talking about 40 tons.
Yeah.
It's what part of my operation could I turn electric? And what customer opportunities, what contracts have I got that could turn electric? So we could just about maybe get into North London from here in Cambridge and get back sensibly, safely. So that's an opportunity. But it's, again, you need to be shifting these vehicles. So I've got in my mind's eye that one of our key customers has a shunt operation all day, which is not a million miles obviously from the depot. So we'll put the EV trial on that shunting during the day, back and forth. Again, good piece for the customer, can see how we can make his supply chain greener. And then again, we are about 95 miles from central hub for pallet line. So we can run to Birmingham with a double decker, yeah, and do a night trunk operation with an EV as well. So now it's double shifted, and now it actually starts to, again, come into this idea that it does actually start to wash its face. So as long, yeah, as it washes its face, you're fine. You're doing the right, you sleep well at night because you're doing the right thing, and it's washing its face. It's not commercial suicide. So that's what we earmark. But again, it's the infrastructure piece. It's the it's the collaboration piece. We're already talking to Pallet Line about, right, well, if I do this and I try it for a couple of weeks, obviously we can make a big song and dance about it. But can I charge it? They've got all sorts of car chargers now at Pallet Line. But again, they're only 22 kilowatt. So am I going to be, because I'm going to need a full charge to come back again, because I'm going to be pulling a double decker. Okay, I've lost 4 ton off the payload, and we all run LSTs now from double deckers because you're getting increased efficiency. So again, we're going to have to be careful with the weight of these over the standard 44 that we're used to running. But yeah, can I charge at the hub? I mean, again, we're having conversations with a lot of infrastructure people coming into the market with starting the first HGV accessible charging parks, and there is actually one being built just outside Coventry already, and I forget the name. Voltempo are doing it, who again we're at our Net Zero Festival. So they will have hopefully an operating EV HGV charging facility by next month, hopefully. So again, that allows us to, if I can't charge at Pallet Line, I can just alter my routing, or we can go to the Pallet Line, we can put it on the Eco Freight, so he drops his trailer in, goes off to the charging hub, gets charged, comes back, picks up the trailer and comes home. So there's commercials around all that, but it can work, and it's about demonstrating to people how it can work.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm all for 40 tons. Just it's going to be a long, long while until your whole fleet's electric, in my eyes.
But you do see a time that it will happen. You think the government's timetable is achievable?
What a question. I think it's achievable. It has to be achievable, and it has to be maintained, in my eyes, because if you start making concessions or exceptions, then that mindset and those people will latch onto that, and it'll become a movement to make it bigger, make a bigger hole in that 100% net zero. Again, we come back, you relate it to the car industry. So I've had an iPace for nearly 3 years now. I do practice what I preach. And I've just bought a C40 Volvo. My iPace on the book does 197 miles. I think it's got like a 75 kilowatt supercharger in it. Very comfortable, love it. Volvo, cheaper, still a great brand. I would class it as second generation, or it's Volvo's first generation really, but it's second generation EV car in my eyes. So I've now jumped in 3 years, 2.5 years, I've jumped to a 350 book range, which, having experienced my iPace in the summer, it says 197, sorry, the book says 197, but I will get a charge today because it's nice outside. I will have 235 mile range when I get in my Jag tonight. I'm hoping, same as to simply said with the Volvo, and I might even push 400 on a good day. So we've already doubled the range, yeah, of the car in one generational step. I've gone from a 75 kilowatt charge or whatever is in my Jag, because it was first generation, to I think it's like 150, 200 kilowatt infrastructure in the Volvo. I can charge zero, they're telling me, I can charge from 0 to 80% in 28 minutes. Where's my Jag? If I pulled up a supercharger, pulled up at our supercharger, like I quite often do, it will take an hour, hour and a quarter to do that same activity, that same charging cycle. So we've actually, in 3 years, in the car industry, doubled the capacity of what that, what vehicles, what cars can do. And I foresee it happening exactly the same with batteries. And again, I'm not poo-pooing hydrogen. There might be another scientific breakthrough that comes up with a new superfuel. You never know, do you? But you, the batteries will get better, the batteries will get smaller, and then you partner that with the infrastructure piece. Obviously, we talk about the fact that our warehouse has a supercharger outside it. If you come and deliver to our warehouse, you could charge your vehicle, and that's the same thing going to be set up. No, Amazon are already trying to do it, Wincanton are already trying to do it. These places that we're going to deliver to need to have the charging facility, even if it's just a 22 kilowatt. It's about charging. It's charging. It's not stopping for charging. It's charging when you're stopped. So don't you don't want to have to go somewhere to charge unless you're on a break. You want to go somewhere, be doing a delivery and charge. And that's, I think that's the way it's going to go. Hydrogen, you are going to have to go somewhere to fill up, but then you're only saying 10-15 minutes to get a full fill from what I've read. So again, and then we build into this idea the fact that obviously we can only drive 4.5 hours max. So 56 miles an hour, 4.5 hours, what's that, 350 miles? So actually my car's now going to do 350 miles. Hopefully the lorry will take the same jump. Maybe it'll take three generations, maybe it'll take 6 years, but once that lorry gets to being able to do 350 miles, actually that's a bit of a game changer, because you know tramping is now feasible. You build in the fact that hopefully lots of other DCs and warehouses will have chargers so you can charge on the go. And they're even trialling, obviously in the continent, they're trialling running it a bit like trams, aren't they, with overhead gantries on the motorways. There's a trial down in Southampton, I think, or Portsmouth, with in a taxi rank, where the taxis have been retrofitted with like charging pads. So like we put our phones on the side now and they charge, these taxis actually have a whatever receiver on the bottom of them. Their taxi ranks have been inbuilt with battery charging technology, however it works, I'm not a scientist, and they passively charge while sat on the taxi rank. And it's the same, and it's the same principle. Like, you, there's all sorts of different culminations of things that can happen that mean I don't need a battery that's twice as big that gives me twice as range. Like, technology will come down and infrastructure will go up and it will meet somewhere in the middle. And again, that's why I also think it is end game is EV, because you can create EV. We've just signed off a 300 kilowatt array for our roof. Like, we are going to create our own EV power. We're going to put batteries on site and then we're going to plow it into our electric vehicles. And that is self-sufficient at that point. I need a hell of a lot of wind and PV to do it. You are taking that step towards properly net zero, and I don't need to rely on the grid. And actually, if I've got batteries on site, whilst obviously there's a lot of talk and there's a lot of rejected applications for feeding back to the grid at the moment, you have a battery on site and they'll bite your hand off to the government and the energy companies if you can facilitate giving back energy when they want it. So actually it changes it around to this idea of having PV, having wind, having a battery. Obviously the payoff is amazing once you start having to plough it into an electric rigid the following day, because you're using it as quick as you can produce it. Most solar arrays now, we've got one going on our workshop next month. The payback for that's 5 years, which is still great at current energy prices. It's going to save us about £1,500 a month. But you look at an ROI on a solar array that's storing it and then putting it into a battery electric vehicle, you're talking like under 2 years, because it is literally just going straight out. You're not having to lose it to the grid and get paid pence on the pound kind of thing. You're not having to sell it back at 6, 7, 8p. You are offsetting that 36p, 25p, whatever tariff you're on, all the time. So the ROI just plummets. And then at that point, and it comes back to your point, Will, about surcharging the electric vehicle. At that point, actually, it's like paying a third less for my diesel. So we might have to do a calculation there where you give some money back. That's not how the industry works. But yeah, so I can actually, I have that pence per kilowatt calculation now for running this EV. Anything I can produce and store and put in my vehicle offsets that amount. And we, well, unlike when we started looking at getting this EV beginning of last year, because of energy prices before war broke out, you had the capital cost. That was a painful bit. And they're not being funny. The running of the vehicle was actually 25 to 30% cheaper than a diesel. So eventually, by the end of the vehicle's life, or the standard life cycle that we talked about, you were coming out about right or saving a little bit. You run it for 8 years or a bit longer, you are obviously saving money. So these energy producing ideas and storage, the ability to store, does actually bring you back down to making these vehicles a lot more cost effective.
Yeah. Brilliant. What could the government do to help hauliers like you to invest in electric vehicles?
Massive rebates. No, at the end of the day, it's the financial aid part, isn't it? Whether it's rebates, whether it's like tax exemptions, something along the lines of a financial aid. Obviously, again, the capital expenditure on these vehicles is enormous. The capital expenditure on a normal diesel is enormous now, yeah, over the last couple of years.
But you're looking at roughly three times the price,
exactly,
aren't you?
And then obviously, whilst Volvo have got a 40 ton on the market, I don't know what the Renault variant's going to be, but again, you're still miles up there, aren't you? Like, say, you're paying what now, 120-ish for a 44 ton tractor diesel. You are going to still be paying 250, 300 for a 40 ton EV that moves 4 ton less.
Yeah.
So it's that support with the purchasing of these assets. And if it has to be done at the purchasing point to maybe people commit to it, then it's still help, isn't it? And there's the other bits in between. Obviously everyone's trialing HVO. A lot of people are trialing HVO now. It's a good stepping stone in my eyes. It's still very expensive. Again, there's taxation around all these fuels, isn't there? It would be great if the government could help subsidise HVO or lower the tax implications on them to bring it closer to diesel, to allow more of us to do it.
Yeah, good point.
So that will, again, get us all a bit closer to that road to net zero, get us to those breaking points. Yeah, it's the financial piece. And again, they need to be helping and facilitating and pushing the infrastructure. Obviously, again, there's a lot of growth in the industry for wanting to build these service stations, these hubs, these place infrastructure parks, charging infrastructure parks, should we call them. So again, it's the government's help to facilitate to build these places, like when the applications come in for whatever site is, and most of them will be green or brown, because you need to start again. I'm sure you can retrofit a lot of service stations, but these places need big inputs of power and a lot of space. A normal trailer park, lorry park, isn't going to work, really. We already know there's not enough of them in the UK. But you're going to have different areas, aren't you? You're going to have your 22 or your 20, 30, 40, 50 kilowatt drip chargers for whilst people are parked up overnight. You can need a whole array of superchargers that will act a bit like fuel pumps where you drive in and drive out again. There's a lot more space and a lot more thought that needs to go into these parks, these charging services. So again, the government needs to be involved and help from that point of view. There's other bits and pieces around it, isn't there? There's the insurance piece. I don't know the impact that legislation has on when you talk about those kind of things. But Harry Campley of Selby had an interesting conversation, because again they've got a 19-ton DAF, and he was telling me that obviously insurers don't know how to price these vehicles, but you start talking to them, he started talking to them about multiple vehicles, and they're like, well, you can't park them next to each other at night, because if one goes up, you get a charging point, and it'll just rip through your fleet. it's a bit like a fire breaking out in your trailer park. So they're already saying, like, you can't just line the, like, I've got a nice rigid parking array of 15 bays out there, and I thought, great, I'm going to put a 22 kilowatt supercharger behind all of them to drift them overnight because they're radio vehicles, they're not used at night. And now I'm thinking, well, am I going to need twice as much space? Because am I going to have to leave X amount of space between vehicles so it's no longer a fire risk?
Yeah, the same way, that wouldn't occur to me.
The same way where you don't leave pallets against your building because for fire insurance purposes. So again, that's not necessarily government, but there's help to be had there, isn't there? There's help that we need to have from the authorities about the public sector, about the fire departments and bits and pieces, about understanding how electricity works, the implications of those kind of things.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things from a lot of authority bodies, shall we say, that could help us on this journey.
Yeah, fascinating. Chris, look, thank you so much for that. So interesting, and thanks for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you for coming to visit us.
No, not at all.